To the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. I am your host, Vic Sage, and for this week's episode, we have a listener request show. As most of you are already aware, when I started out with the podcast, I had initially intended only to discuss the games we had at the arcade. I quickly realized that there were far too many classic arcade games that we haven't been lucky enough to obtain at the Arcadia Retrocade as of yet. It didn't seem right not to discuss them, especially when loyal listeners to the podcast request a game, like the subject of our show today, that 1983 mix of shooter and platformer from Taito. I am, of course, talking about Elevator Action. My first introduction to Elevator Action actually wasn't at Showbiz Pizza or Games People Play. It wasn't even at the skating rink or bowling alley of my youth. I found it one Saturday afternoon down at the local gas station, just down the street from my home. The very same spot that I mentioned in the Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator episode. A new arcade game showing up at that gas station was a pretty big deal for me. For one thing, since the station was just down the street, it meant it was easier to visit than the arcades or other spots in my neck of the woods. Plus, since my father had to drive a little ways to work every day, we bought our gas there, generally, two or three times a week. Far easier to ask my father for a single quarter and a chance to play a game while he was at the pump. The first time I played Elevator Action, I had to wait my turn. There were some other teenagers playing it. Thankfully, my father wasn't in a hurry, so he sat out in the car for a few minutes while I waited until the older boys were finished. As I've mentioned in other shows, there were a few times that teenagers were less than friendly to me. I'm glad to say this was not one of those cases. They were engaged in a two-player game, and while one friend was playing, the other would fill me in on the object of the game. They even stuck around and watched me play the game, although I have to admit to you all, I definitely didn't do as well as they did. With some of the other arcade games back in the day, I could find a bit of help in a few of the video game magazines, like Joystick or Electronic Games, to name a few. I honestly do not recall ever seeing one of the magazines covering Elevator Action. However, I did happen to catch it on one of the greatest game shows of all time, TBS's video game show, Starcade.
Kevin will tell us about the five games in store for us today. Kev?
Jeff, we've got five pretty challenging games today for our contestants. First, it's Donkey Kong 3, Bug Spray and Coconuts with the Beast. Next, it's Star Wars, The Red 5 and Obi. In the middle today, Motor Race USA, a low-riding biker coast to coast. Juno First, Far Out and Blastin'. And Elevator Action, a game with its ups and downs. Jeff?
I feel like I should cover Starcade in a special episode one of these days. Let me know what you think about that. Alright, as I've discussed on a few of the other shows, Elevator Action is a game where I've been unable to find out who was in charge of development and designing of the game. I mean, I've found information about the ports that were in development for the Atari 2600 and Atari 5200, although never finished or officially released. I have talked a bit about Taito, the company that developed and released Elevator Action in the past, in particular with the Space Invaders episode. A brief recap is that the company was founded in 1953 by Michael Kogan, who was a businessman of Ukrainian descent, as the Taito Trading Company Limited, set up to facilitate the import and export of vending machines. It also happened to distill and even sell vodka in Japan, the very first company to do so. After becoming the Taito Corporation in 72, 1 year later, they were producing their first video game. That same year, they set up Taito America, although its function was to license Taito games to third-party publishers. Like how Space Invaders was released in North America by Midway. It wouldn't be until the end of the 70s that Taito America would begin publishing their own titles, most of course originating from Japan. Some of the more notable arcade classics they produced include 1981's Kix, with Jungle Hunt and Zookeeper the following year, Elevator Action, of course, as well as Bubble Bobble in 1986, to name a few. At the very least, I did learn that it was Yoshino Imamura who composed the catchy tune for Elevator Action. In addition, Yoshino also provided the music for Chakampop, which many fans look on as being the forerunner to the popular Bubble Bobble series. Elevator Action tasks 1 to 2 players taking alternate turns with guiding the sweater-wearing Agent 17, codename Otto, with the aid of a four-way joystick, allowing movement up and down as well as left and right. Pulling down on the joystick will allow Otto to duck low to the ground, useful for avoiding enemies firing at him. The player has entered into a top-secret defense building by way of an opening on the top floor of the building. Otto's mission is to locate and steal government documents that are being stored behind red-colored doors in various spots of the 30-floor building. The main way to travel through the building, floor by floor, is through the use of the multitude of elevators, and sometimes even escalators. After collecting all the documents behind the red doors, Otto must make it to the ground floor, where his red sports car is waiting for him to make his exit. If the player manages to miss one of the documents behind a red door and makes it to the getaway car, they will be teleported to the floor where the missing document is located. Then they have to try and escape successfully once again. Obviously, this enemy top secret defense building hasn't been left unguarded. There are enemy agents in black hats and trench coats on the prowl. Thankfully, Otto has 2 ways to defend himself. A jump button that, when pressed, will allow him to leap up in the air, very useful for avoiding enemy agents' bullets. You can also press on the joystick to the right and left and leap in those directions. You can use the jump button to kick those enemy agents in the face and knock them out. You can also leap across an open elevator shaft if you are careful, but only if the elevator is above you. The cable attached to the elevator will prevent you from leaping over or even crossing it otherwise. And although you can walk on top of an elevator, at least to the cable, this can be very dangerous, as you can be crushed if an enemy agent is in control of the elevator beneath you. Another important safety tip is either your own or the enemy's bullets can pass through the cable, so be prepared to leap up to avoid them, unless you want to lose one of your extra lives. Besides the jump button, there's also a fire button that allows Otto to pull out his gun and shoot up to 3 bullets in whichever direction he is currently facing. With only 3 of the player's bullets allowed on the screen at the same time, it is best to just use the gun when you know a bullet will hit an enemy agent and take them out. In addition, the gun can be fired while operating the elevator. To not just hit an enemy agent, you can also shoot the hanging lamps on the ceiling, causing them to plummet to the ground. This is, of course, especially useful if an enemy agent happens to be standing under one of them, cracking them on the skull and knocking them out. This also serves to extinguish the light in the building for a short time. Enemy agents taken out by players' shots or kicks now will result in a higher score. And I've read online that by destroying a lamp, it causes the enemy agents to slow down just a little bit. After a short amount of time, the lights will come back on. It should also be noted that there are always a couple of floors in the building, floors 15 through 11, where the lights are permanently off. This results in making it a bit tougher to locate the agents, who are a dark blue while the lights are off. Having said that, the red doors always stand out at least. Speaking of those red doors, to enter them, the player will stop on the red floor mats in front of the door and push the joystick in the direction of the doorknob. Upon exiting the red door, Otto has some of the documents under his arms, and the player has earned a nice bump to their score. If there are too many enemy agents hanging around after you've entered the red door, you can wait inside for 5 seconds, exiting by pushing left on the joystick. Just be prepared, especially in later levels, to emerge from the door and be ready to fire on the enemy agents. If you wait too long, of course, the game will kick you out from behind the door on its own. Remember, you will have to visit every single red door in order to complete a level and move on to the next building. Besides the red door where the secret documents are hidden, the top secret defense building has numerous blue doors throughout the building. These are where the enemy agents will emerge from. Otto cannot enter any of these doors. Before we get into a little more detail about the elevators, let me take just a moment to discuss those escalators. When you are at the topmost section of the building, you will have a single elevator to worry about, until the 19th floor, which I believe in every building is where that particular elevator ends. From there, the player will be forced to take escalators, which are situated on the far left and right of the screen. By standing on the blue and red mats, then pulling down, Otto will hop onto the escalator and head down to the next floor. If the player finds that they need to go back up a level on the escalator, they just simply press up on the joystick while standing on one of those blue and red mats. While traveling on the escalator, you will not be able to jump, fire off a shot, or duck. On the other hand, you are 100% safe while you're riding an escalator. You can't be shot. As soon as you step off, though, you better hope an enemy agent isn't ready to plug you. For a game called Elevator Action, it shouldn't be too shocking to learn that a player is going to have to deal with a few elevators, right? The thing you should remember is that while you are in the elevator itself, while you won't be able to duck enemy agents' bullets, you have complete control of the elevator, moving up and down by pressing the joystick in the desired direction. Most importantly, this means you can use the top and bottom of the elevator itself to absorb bullets fired by your enemies, allowing you the opportunity to return fire and taking them out. You can fire just as you clear the edge of a floor, your bullets taking out agents at the legs, or just blasting them in the face as they attempt to head towards the elevator. You can also use the elevator as a weapon itself, crushing enemy agents that are below the elevator on ground levels of the building. Although, especially in later stages, this can be a dangerous action. While it might be satisfying to see the elevator shudder as it crushes the enemy, you lose control of the elevator for about a second or so, which makes it easier for another enemy agent to shoot at you, and you won't be able to react to it. A player can also move the elevator when an agent is attempting to abort it, causing the enemy agent to plummet to their death. Players have to be careful jumping over an elevator shaft or into the elevator too. If Otto misjudges his leap and falls even one level, he loses a life. To make things a little more difficult for the player, there are some floors in the later stages where there are multiple elevators connected to a single cable, which means you might be heading to an open elevator, but an enemy agent 2 levels below you has entered an empty elevator car first and moves it before you can get inside and take control. By the time you've reached the bottom levels, or floors of the building, things get pretty difficult, even in the early stages, because floors 11 through 7 have 2 elevators in operation on the left and right side of the screens, meaning the player will have to cross hallways to be able to access the elevators. Floors 6 through 1, though, have 5 elevators going. Many times, a player will have to try and cross from one side of the screen to the other, pausing on small ledges between the elevators, all the while shooting agents and jumping over or ducking enemy fire from the other agents in the numerous elevators or emerging from the sides of the building from behind those blue doors. Not to sound like a broken record, especially in the later stages, I have seen videos online where it just gets nuts. It's almost like the video game equivalent of watching a John Wick film. Now, sometimes the elevators that do operate on their own, if no one is in them, will be moving up and down and end up stopping bullets headed your way. But don't count on that to save you. All right, last but not least, we're going to talk about the enemy agents. While they aren't able to leap at you or over your bullets, they definitely outnumber you. as well as the fact they will seek Otto out. If you're on an upper or lower floor, they will either use an elevator to get to your floor or an escalator. The agents also have the ability to duck down and fire at the player. And I'm positive that in later stages, they can fire from a prone position as well, which means you can only shoot them by using that elevator trick to send a bullet skimming across the floor. In addition, the agents are capable of just firing blindly, which kind of stinks if you aren't paying attention and you're traveling downward on an elevator and a bullet smashes into your leg and costs you a life. Another element to keep in mind with elevator action is you only have a limited amount of time to collect those secret documents behind the red doors. Although you won't see a timer while you're playing the game has an internal clock that goes off if you have taken too long, causing an alarm to sound. While you won't lose a life when your time is up, the agents will begin to move and shoot faster bullets. Plus, more and more of them will begin to appear to hunt the player down. The really bad situation is that even if you lose a life, the alarm will still be going off. You can only stop it by clearing the building like normal. The scoring system in elevator action is pretty straightforward. If you kick an agent, you get 150 points, 200 if it's in the dark. You will earn 100 points for each agent shot, 150 if it's in the dark areas. You get 300 points for taking out an agent with a falling lamp. The same amount of score for crushing an enemy agent with the elevator itself. You will net 500 points for each document collected behind a red door. And you get 1,000 points times the current stage you're on for clearing a stage. So 1,000 for the first stage, and then 2,000 points for the second building, so on and so forth. Although, after building or stage 10, you will always get 10,000 points after clearing the building, which is useful because you do get an extra man for every 10,000 points.
And now, these messages.
Enter the imagination of Atari. The imagination that brings you the world's most popular video games, like Jungle Hunt, where you have to swing from vine to vine to save the girl from cannibals. And Dig Dug, where you make your own maze, then have to deal with it. And Pole Position, where Grand Prix racing comes to dizzying life. Experience the challenges and the thrills that come only from the imagination of Atari.
Out here, we entertain ourselves at home. So we got an Atari video game. There's so many different games to play. We especially like Space Invaders, zapping those little devils from outer space. It's fun, but personally, I think the whole idea of creatures from outer space is a little far-fetched.
No other company offers you as many different video game cartridges as Atari.
As I mentioned earlier in the show, elevator action didn't make it to the Atari 2600 or 5200. Interestingly enough, the idea that there had even been a port of the classic arcade game was thought to be a myth. But while not completely finished, I've read online that Dan Hitchens had been working on an Atari 2600 version of the game back in the day. The crazy part is, it looks really good. Hitchens also programmed a few other arcade ports for the 2600, Berserk in 82, as well as Mario Brothers and Gravatar the following year. In addition, he was the co-designer of Atari's Sword Quest, at least for Earthworld, under the guidance of Todd Fry, who you might know for his porting of Pac-Man to the 2600. An unfairly maligned game port, I would add. One of these days, I'm going to have to tackle the Sword Quest series on the podcast. To speak a little more about the elevator action ports is the esteemed Earl Green of thelogbook.com.
We have transport.
I can't really exactly remember the first time I set eyes on an elevator action machine in an arcade. It obviously would have been sometime in 1983, probably at my regular haunt, which was the Games R Us in Fort Smith, over behind the Burger King and next to the Tuxedo Place. Funny, the things you can remember about your favorite arcade, such as what was close by. There were a few home ports of this game. Atari attempted to do one, but it was never released until an unfinished version was unearthed and released in 2001 at the Classic Gaming Expo. It's an interesting port of the game. It's obviously trying to deliver as close to the arcade experience as it can within the 2600's limitations. It has no sound, and you have really... Your character has an interesting amount of control over the elevator. You can kind of stop between floors and fire at people's feet, that sort of thing. But they can also fire at you while you're doing that. So not really a great port. The red doors, for example, in the 2600 version, you just touch them, boom, you have the secret document, you're free to go again. If only the arcade game worked like that, I would probably be a lot better at it. There were versions on the Sinclair Spectrum, the Amstrad CPC in the European market, the MSX computer, the Commodore 64, the Sega SG-1000, and of course the NES. The NES version is pretty solid. My favorite home version that arrived fairly soon after the arcade game, and this is fairly soon is kind of relative because we're talking early 90s. My favorite home version was on the Game Boy because it added a few modern touches, such as instead of instantly dying, you had, you know, you kind of had your heart health meter, sort of like The Legend of Zelda. So you could take a certain amount of damage before you keeled over. And you could also pick up extra weapons such as machine guns and grenades with which to wreak further havoc in your quest to get out of the building. Compared to such games as Popeye or The Empire Strikes Back, Elevator Action was not that widely ported for home play. And so any home version, any decent home version that we got was a treasure. Of course, now it's in the Nintendo eShop for your Switch. It's on the Taito Legends compilation for everything from the PS2 and Xbox onward. And of course, there were a couple of fairly good revivals of it on the Game Boy Color and the Game Boy Advance. So Elevator Action hasn't gone away quietly. It just, as far as home console and computer ports, didn't make a lot of noise to begin with.
As I mentioned earlier in the show, at the Arcadia Retrocade, we have yet to obtain an Elevator Action. Although, I know that, like Zookeeper, Shay has constantly been on the lookout for an affordable cabinet. Although, I did read on the Old School Gamer magazine site that Taito had partnered up with My Arcade to produce both Bubble Bobble and Elevator Action Micro Machine cabinets. I'll include a link to that announcement on the podcast post on the Pop Culture Retrorama site. I received a very nice email from SC on the Popeye episode last week. They also asked a couple of questions about the arcade I thought I would take a second and answer on the show. The arcade at the moment is still closed due to COVID-19. At the time of this recording, our neck of the woods has had a kind of scary upswing in cases. Enough so that the New York Times took notice, actually. Hopefully everything will get settled soon and Shay can open the doors once again. I can tell you this, though. Gary Burton, who's our main tech, as well as Shay, have been working nonstop, morning, day, and night, getting the second wing of the arcade up and running. If you check out the Diary Facebook page, you can see some of the progress. Another question that was brought up by SC, and I get this one quite a bit, is to explain my position at the arcade in more detail. That is super easy. I am a doorman. Plain and simple. I stand at the podium and greet the players that come in, explain the rules of the arcade, as well as walk the floor, cleaning up messes, but more importantly, helping players have a fun time. Maybe show younger players how to work the Atari 2600, or if time permits, depending on the game, I might even show them some fun little tricks on the game itself. That is it, friends. At the end of the night, after locking up, it's my task to clean every single machine, restock the concession stand if need be, and leave a note for Shay, who comes in to work early in the mornings, letting him know if there's anything he should be made aware of. I'm in no way a business partner or co-owner of the arcade. There's only one grand poobah calling the shots, and that is, of course, Shay Mathis. I've said this before, but besides being a doorman, my job, I guess, is to act as historian for the Arcadia Retrocade. It's my fellow co-workers, Ree, Grace, Madeline, Sarah, and Elle, of course, Gary Burton and Shay himself, these are the people who make the arcade shine. They do all the real work, especially as my, quote, day job requires me to work the weekends. Speaking of real work, I'm glad to say that we have a new segment for the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast featuring none other than Gary Burton, whose segment concerns being an actual arcade employee. Here he is to give you a glimpse of what his job entails at the arcade.
Hello, everyone. Gary here, the head game tech at Arcadia Retrocade, filling you in on some recent work I've been up to lately. While we've been closed since mid-March, I've been using that quiet time to bring some dead games back to life and get them back on the main floor for our guests to enjoy when we're able to open our doors again. One of my projects is creating the Berserk sequel using an empty Berserk cabinet as a donor. I'm sure remember Stern's 1980 arcade hit Berserk had a sequel with Frenzy in 1982. I knew we had nearly all the parts in storage, so I gathered them all together the last few months to see what we could do with them. My original intention over the weekend was to open Frenzy up and see what hardware would be needed to transform the old Berserk into the sequel. I was missing the CRT circuit board, a power supply, and the main PCB that contains all the ROM chips that make Frenzy a Frenzy and not some other Stern game. Except for the ROMs, the guts are exactly like a Berserk game. I wanted to get the game to play blind. What that means is I wanted the game to play, make all the sounds credit up exactly as it would in the arcade, except you can't see the screen because, well, the board was missing from the monitor. So I installed a switch and power supply to replace the non-existent original power supply. That way the game runs cooler and much more efficiently. I was going to try the Berserk main board since I knew it was working fine. I pulled it out of our working Berserk game, and as I took it out, I noticed that the battery backup looked really bad and original. Turns out it really was the original backup battery from 1981, January 1981 to be more specific, and it started leaking acid all over the board. I unsoldered the old battery and took the board home with me. I made a mixture of baking soda and water, dipped the board into it, scrubbed the traces of the battery were, and removed all the acid. And I dried the board and set it to dry overnight. Replacement was a little tricky with this thing. They don't exactly make replacement batteries for these things just over the counter. It is possible to do it with a simple watch battery and some new leads, but you do have to put a diode into the system because a watch battery isn't designed to be recharged like the replacement battery would be on the board. The idea of the replacement battery is that the game would recharge the battery to keep the current high scores in place when you turn the game off and back on again. A local department store nearby only carried a 2.4 cordless phone rechargeable battery, but I needed a 3.6 volt. On my way out, I saw a display of rechargeable cell phone battery packs that you plug a USB cord into and recharge your phone. They put out exactly the 3.6 volts I needed. I went home and found the lipstick case recharger that my daughter had given me back last year from college. I ripped the case off of it and found the 3.6 volt battery inside, clipped the leads, and today I soldered those leads to the board and attached it with some firm double-sided grippy tape, and I put it back in the machine. I powered up the game, and except for the high scores being erased, the game works great. This still doesn't get Frenzy any closer to working, but I managed to save the Berserk PCB from terminal damage from happening. The battery acid had also eaten away at the two Frenzy boards, far worse than what I found on Berserk, and I'd already start working on to halt that damage. Hopefully we'll have a fully functioning Berserk game here before long. Hey everybody, thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great day, and come see us at the arcade as soon as you can. Bye-bye.
And friends, I think that about wraps up our episode. As always, I want to thank you again for taking the time to listen to the show. I really do appreciate your support and hope that you are enjoying this second season of the podcast. I know I'm no expert, just a fan of classic arcade and home console games, and I really do enjoy talking about them. The Diary of an Arcade Employee is currently available on iTunes. I'm working on rebuilding that podcast library, a result of switching from the Retroist site to the Pop Culture Retrorama one. I hope you'll check out our daily posts by visiting www.popculturetrorama.com. The Diary of an Arcade Employee is available on Google Podcasts as well as Spotify. No matter how you listen to the show, if you have a moment and enjoy the podcast, why not give us a rating and a review to help us find new listeners? You can find out more about the Arcadia Retrocade by visiting Facebook. Or, for daily posts, you can check out the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast Facebook page. I share all manner of vintage arcade and home console fun multiple times a day. As I previously mentioned, Earl Green is a frequent contributor to the Pop Culture Retrorama site, as well as being a very good friend to the arcade. Most of the collection of home console games and other goodies have been donated by Earl. Earl heads up thelogbook.com, one of the longest-running websites for literally all things pop culture related. I want to thank Gary Burton again for agreeing to become part of the show. Gary generally shares photographs from the arcade that I share on the Diary of an Arcade Employee Facebook page. If you have any feedback or comments about the podcast, you can always reach me on Facebook or throw me an email at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. While not in the last few months, you can also often find me posting videos of the arcade on my Instagram account, which is simply vicsage_. I, of course, want to thank the Retroist. For over a decade, the Retroist provided a spot on the internet where fans of all things retro could visit and enjoy the best retro-related articles and podcasts. If it wasn't for the retro support, I certainly wouldn't have multiple podcasts of my own, or my own website now. After a brief hiatus, the Retroist has started posting on his website once again. He's even working on new podcasts, so make sure to check it out. Now take a moment and listen to a clip of the game I'll talk about next week. This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by Taito, Atari, or any of the individuals and businesses that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips from the mentioned video games and ads are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.
Going up, sir.
End of line.